Lois is our historian and our archivist, and he's going to sort of be Mr. Interlocutor or something like that.
Well, we also have Duffy here, Duffy Hamilton, who knows a great deal about Dalton too, so maybe just a little bit.
I grew up here when there wasn't.
Wasn't any Dalton?
Well, ready?
All right.
What
well, I don't know what you want to talk about, but let me start in with a little bit of opening comment here, then we can go on from there. You know, as you grow a little older, you get your twilight years, you begin to wonder how you got here, what you've accomplished, and what's happened. So, to begin with, I came from Zionsville, Indiana. We came to Tualatin in September of 1925. We moved up on the Moulton place, which is on the Tualatin Road. It was, at that time, on the south side of the road, two houses past the cemetery. I don't know whether you people have ever heard of J.B. Pilkington Nursery.
Yes.
Well, my father worked for J.B. Pilkington Nursery, and back in those days, it was a large concern. They had three places. They had 40 acres on the Boonsbury Road down at Durham, they had 40 acres on Sam Galton's place, and they had 25 acres at the intersection of Childs Road and Pilkington. And that ran down to the water that went into the lake. And Abel Picken took care of the home place, my dad took care of the Galbert place, and Slim Davis took care of the Pilkington Road, the Child Road place. In those days, that was a going concern, because they landscaped the Meyer Estate, which is now Lewis and Clark College, and that job was over $1 million. And they landscaped the Aaron Frank Estate at Garden Home, and that was over $1 million.
Back in those days, it was $1 million.
Yes. The 1932 Olympics was held in Los Angeles, and they built that Coliseum in Los Angeles, similar to the Coliseum in Rome. And of course, when they wanted to landscape that, they wanted those trees to look like they'd been there 30 or 40 years. So they would dig those trees and put three of them on a flat car, and they'd go a train down to L.A. And those men that dug those with no power equipment, spade and shovel, the shiplap box, get them out of the hole with a horse, sled them down to Durham, and pull them up on the train. They put two boxes going this way and one going the other way. Be three of them to a flat car load. And they had a retail office down at 2nd and Taylor in Portland. But what happened is somebody sold them a patented rose, and they went ahead and grew it and sold it, and the person that held the patent on it sued them and put them out of business. And so that thing went to Gunny's Act in about 1933, along with the rest of the trouble. Anyway, we lived on the Galbraith place, and in 1928, I started grade school from the Galbraith place. That's just across the river, where all those apartments is, short of the railroad track. And of course, being 5 years old, my parents was afraid for us to walk across. I had a sister who was afraid to walk across the river because there wasn't any sidewalks until we got down to Boone's Ferry and Martin Asley. There wasn't a sidewalk, it was a path. So they would take us down to Mrs. Cole's place, because you have to realize school here didn't start till 9 o'clock. It doesn't start at 7:30 like it did, it started at 9. Well, other people, most of the people there, was working both, like they are now. And so they would take us down to Mrs. Cole's place. She'd keep us there till about 8:15, and then we'd walk from there up to the grade school. Hi there. We'd walk up there to the grade school. And then at night, you'd get off at 4 o'clock and make it back home in daylight. But now, as we left home, and we walked up to Tualatin. And the first place of business you'd come to was James's Pool Hall. You have to realize that this was during Prohibition, and there wasn't any hard liquor, so it was a pool hall. And he was a barber. And about 31, 32 in that area, he sold out to a fellow by the name of George Plow.
And where was that,
sir? That was the first business that you came to. It was right where Richie's, you know, where Country Kitchen or...
Oh, okay. Yeah, I know. I thought I wondered if it
went. But see, when James lived there, next to it was living quarters. They had living quarters in the thing. But he was a barber.
Uh-huh.
And Plow, he was a barber when he came.
So they had a barber shop right there?
Yeah. And of course, Plow was there when beer came in.
Uh-huh.
Which was about 1934.
Now, did they
stand enough business for two of them?
What? What?
Did they have enough business for two barbers?
No, they were, one sold out to the other one.
Oh, okay. I was wondering. It's pretty little.
But, well, yeah, there was a lot of homemade haircuts in those days. Because the times were tough.
How many people paid for a haircut?
I mean, we were poor, but we didn't know it because we were the same as everybody else. Anyway, you would come up, that first place of business with James. Then there was a feed store, a building in there for a feed store, mm-hmm. in between, and you came to the brick store. Mm-hmm. That was run by Kilpatrick. Mm-hmm. And he lived in Lake Grove, and he ran that store. He had a brother, Tom, that lived in Sherwood. He ran a store in Sherwood, and they had one children. Mm-hmm. So that was the beginning of supermarket there, yeah. Before you knew about right. Supermarkets. Mm-hmm. Then you rounded the corner, and you had a doctor's office, old Doc Schroeder. That was where that Mays Cafe was in that building.
Oh.
And then Mrs. Jones or Mrs. Newt Robinson, she had a garage. The Legion Hall or the VFW Hall wasn't built then. Then you had Ed Robinson's store.
Mm-hmm.
And then you had the Hawkshurst Meat Market. And to the south there, he had living quarters on that building. Then you had the post office, it was run by J.H. Shimoni. Then you had a small 10 by 12 building with Dr. Vincent. Had, well, maybe office hours there once a week. It wasn't a very big building.
You mean there were two doctors at the same time?
No. Dr. Schroeder had quit by then. And that's the reason that Vincent came from, he had hours in Beaverton, I think, and he was here about one day a week. And then you had where Hannigan's was. So that was the extent of the business. So that, the next thing was the Methodist Church.
Yeah.
The brickyard was done, everything was done, and that was the extent of the business. The Oregon Electric train service went out, I believe, in about 31. They started the 12 Valley Stages.
When did the Soviet lumber company come in?
Be after the war.
After the war.
Be after the war, because most everything, you know, went to the war effort during the war.
Right.
So that pretty well takes care of that. Now, Lois had asked me about sports, you know, did we do anything? And, you know, down in the old park where it is today, years ago, in the late teens and early 20s, they had a ball diamond down there, but it wasn't very large. You know, it's, a person nowadays hit a ball out across the railroad track and never find it. And so they never, as I was a youngster around town, from the old middle 20s on up, they moved the ball diamond up to where it was adjacent to Laura Thompson's place. It's on that map to look where they dug that city well. It was on, butted up against her place in Nyberg Road. And that's where they played the baseball. Of course, they always had a town team. And then in about 1933 or 34, you hear of Slim and Laura Camp? Well, his name was Julian. It was J.J. Camp. His name was Julian Jared Camp, so that's why they called him Slim. And they were young people. They were young people, and they came from Park Rose. And Slim Camp, Kilpatrick wanted to get out of the feed business, and Slim Camp came with Triangle Mills, and they started a feed business here in Florida.
Fred, just a minute now. clarify this for me. Kilpatrick had the store, the brick store,
yeah.
And he also ran the feed store.
He sold feed.
I knew Kilpatrick.
Huh?
I knew Kilpatrick.
What was his first name?
I forgot.
Marcus.
Marcus?
Marcus A. Kilpatrick.
What? Told you he knew everything.
Yeah.
And he was real, he could stand in the shade behind a telephone pole. And he didn't have much hair on his head. I think he lived down in Keelock Circle there at the lake.
Yes, he did. Mm-hmm. Did you know him, Betty?
I know the name. I don't remember him.
Laura and Slim Camp came to town, and they started in, you can pass this around, they started in with, you know, getting the kids some activities.
Cool.
Well, at the old grade school, the ceiling in old grade school is only about 10 foot high, so basketball wasn't very popular. But they did play it there. They played it there. But when they built the
kids are short at work.
when they built the new grade school, they built a real nice gymnasium. And it was fun to play basketball there. But anyway, Mr. and Mrs. Camp, they footed most of the bills. You know, they hauled the kids around. We didn't have cars. Went around to all these functions, but there in that picture there, I believe that picture was taken in 48. And the Odd Fellows did put up a couple $100 for a uniform and basketballs for sponsorship.
So where was the grade school built? Was that what Tualatin Elementary is now? Was that built as a grade school or was that a high school?
The old grade school was where the Chelan apartments were.
Oh, really?
The high school was on top of the grade school.
Oh, okay. So was that Tualatin Elementary, that was originally a high school?
No.
Or was that the new elementary school?
Yeah. The new elementary school was built of brick.
Yeah.
Well, that was built in 1938.
Uh-huh.
And.
That
they quit the high school here in 36.
Oh, they did.
And they bonded together with Tonquin and Malloy and Sherwood and built a Union High School at Sherwood.
Okay, so they didn't have one.
No. So what happened, Sherwood had gone to Tigard.
Mm-hmm.
And at Tigard High School, I think if you look over there, it says it was built in 26. And they went to school there.
Hmm.
And then the principal there, Tommy Fowler, could get some people from Beaverton and Maplewood and Garden Home. So he told Sherwood they had to get out. And then those people went there 2 years and then Beaverton came home. So Tualatin and Sherwood and Moy and Tompkin had to all go together to bond in order to build a school. So we started over there in the fall of 36. But after playing basketball, we didn't play much baseball because softball came in about that particular time. And softball was pretty popular, and you could play in Portland, you could play at night. See, the baseball stuff always tied up a Sunday, but they played on Sunday. And so when they had the lights in Portland and everything, and they had quite a league going, they played at nights. And you know, you could work and still play softball and not tie up a Sunday too, you know, playing all day. So that pretty well takes care of that. And what I did was, on this thing here, I brought these pictures along because my wife was a descendant of the Barhams. And they're all gone, and the only two that's left us out of there is, the only one that's left us out of the Barham deal is Rod Dickinson. Other than that, I've ended up with all of the things. And this is a copy of the original donation land claim That's the family there. That's Elizabeth and Edward. This is Ella Barham, John Barham, Joseph Barham, and Addie. And that was the extent of their family. She passed away in 1904. She always wanted to see the Lewis and Clark pair, but it was in 1905. And he passed away in 1912. Now, this lady here married Zeke Eddy. And John Barham stayed over in Graysville, Idaho. I don't really know who he married. Joe Barham married Jesse Steyer, and Addie married Dwayne Eady. Now, John Bowles isn't here, but here's a picture of that barn that was telling him that they built out of that $7.50 1,000 board feet lumber. Now, up in the Barham house, in that gray-shaped house, when you looked out through there, there was two gigantic English walnut trees. And, of course, that's the apple orchard that's down over the hill, and they milk cows, and that's a eight-ball milk house in those days. Because, you know, here we had the Red Rock Dairy, and all the farmers shipped their milk to the Red Rock Dairy, or if they separated, they took it to Larson's Creamery. But the Red Rock Dairy went bankrupt in hard times, too. So that kind of left the farmers without a place to go with their product.
No, Red Rock Dairy was on what they now
72nd, right up the top of the hill, just where you hit Pacific Highway. It was owned by the West.
High school bus passed every day in the school.
Well, I mean, that was tough times, and of course, as you all know, the big milk war was around here, and you want to dump the milk in the river and shoot the guys for delivering the milk, and you had a grade-A dairy here in town, and Inexmaws had a grade-A dairy here in town that was pasteurizing milk back in the 30s. Didn't sell much of it because the taste burned. But anyway, they had a big deal down here at the river. They was going to stop the truck, the vigilantes, and throw the milk in the river, and all that stuff there. That was the starting of the dairy cooperative. They wanted to control the fluid milk supply. They wanted everybody to give the milk to them, and then they'd distribute it back the way it went. So that lasted about 2 weeks. Well, what happened, the reason I know, is the kid used to shag milk on those routes. We left town here at 12 o'clock at night. We got back 12 o'clock the next day because there wasn't any refrigeration. You had to deliver that milk every day. So we'd just go to Walker's one night and go around to Jurgis Park the next night. And next night, the bridge would be open. We'd just bypass the vigilantes. So anyway, that's just a little insight there. Then I brought a picture. My wife's parents was the Blank, August Blank family. They came from South Dakota. And they came here, I think, in 1907 or 1908. They were Mary Guyberger and Hulda Tiedemann was Gus Blank's sister. Their names that's been around town here for a long, long time. That picture there is Gordon Blank, the smallest one there, was born in 1910. So you can figure out about when that picture was, maybe 1916.
You remember Gus Blank was janitor there at the school all the time.
Well, you can't call him janitor anymore, they're custodian.
Well, he was janitor several hundred years ago.
Maintenance engineer.
That's a picture of Ed Blank and his wife.
Oh, that's Ed Blank.
Well, the Blanks came here, and where Kent's started that feed story, they had a kind of a machine shop there. I'm not mistaken, I think Oscar Judd, Harry Judd, one of the others of them, had a garage in there. Then he left, and that was their camp. What's that street that comes out where the show's on? Went past the old fire hall? I mean, what's the name of that street?
Seneca?
Huh?
I don't know. Which way are you talking?
Well, he comes from Bloomsbury to Dunbar.
Oh, okay.
Anyway, that machine shop was right in the end. If you went out that street and crossed the road, you'd run right straight into it. About a little bit up to where George Summers built that store. Well, that's where camps were started. And they were there maybe a year, year and a half, and then when Chuck Patrick put it all together, they moved over.
Well, he ended up with a big, big store in almost that same spot when he finally quit the business.
Well, yeah, what he did was during the war, he went to town, went to work at the shipyard. And he turned that over to Clayton, Nyberg, and Elwood Dunbar. And they moved an old onion barn up from down in Headland's driveway. They moved that up there by their main place, and they sold the feed during the war, and then after the war was over, when Slim came back, it was back in the feed store again. Because they were in the feed store on this basketball deal.
Well, I know when I played with Jerry Camp, the oldest of the boys, we moved every bale of hay in there. Went siblings playing house and all kinds of stuff.
That's a dangerous business.
Yeah.
Playing in the barn.
There's a picture of Dorothy Dickinson. That's the girls in her class. She was a barb.
Fred, you've got to put names on the backs of these pictures.
Names and dates.
Wonderful pictures.
It's 1948.
Do I have a pen?
No, it's gone.
Oh, that's the only one. So far.
Yeah.
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 You
have to.
48?
Yeah. Someday
you
will be here.
That's those two people there. See, they owned the meat market, and after they got rid of the meat market, they went to the custodial work at school.
Oh.
And then when the old school quit, they wanted to quit, but they wanted to stay one more year in the new school.
And so they
stayed one year in the new school, and then Hurley Turnbull took it over.
Yeah.
Here's another one of the
Turnbull was there,
and
we moved here.
Well, Hurley Turnbull and Jim Johnson used to work at the golf links before he was custodian of the school. But his dad was custodian of the Sherwood Boys School, Curly Turnbull's dad. Yeah. So that's a picture of the Byron girls there. This is Earl Byron, that's John Byron's boy. He had a boy and a girl, and they were about the same age.
Well, Ed Byron must have been pretty well to do.
Who?
Ed Byron.
Ed Byron? It's about like Zeke. I think he was more of a land merchant.
Now, I can remember people when I was a kid talking about Byron. They didn't say Byron, they said Barn. Is that the way it used to be pronounced? Kind of Byron? Do you remember that?
I just called him Byron.
Byron.
But my mother-in-law told me that their real name over in England was Byron.
And Glenn.
But Lord Byron, that lady, had some little bit of problems. It disgraced him, so when he came to this area, he changed the end to him.
I'd be curious to find out, you know, if I research that past.
Anyway, what he was a scholar. That's what. But you know, they settled here and they hit the gold and silver. They hit the gold and silver over in Idaho, so they took off for Idaho over the gold and silver. This is his day book. It starts out in 1870.
Oh, what a treasure!
And this is all handwritten in here of different people, different things that he's done. And you've got Ah Wing, the Chinaman, he gave him $50. So, you know, all these people here had Chinese families, you know, living here. That's what they got their work done. There was a lot of hops. Up here on the Neyland place and Zeke Eddy's place, those were both hop yards. And most all the families had a Chinese family that worked there. It's like up at Joe Byron's place, they cradled the grain, they did it all by hand and bound it up. before all the modern. But this is a book that starts in Idaho. They ran a hotel, an eating joint, a wagon train supply thing.
Oh my word.
And when you, I looked at my paper the other day, and it said that New York State was $7.99 a pound, and I think you could buy half a log in here for $7.99.
That's really precious. Old man's old man's
That's Gus.
Oh, Gus.
And here is a copy of Zeke Eddy and Ella Barnes' marriage license.
Oh,
1882. I have my grandparents' marriage license written on a in pencil on a pad of paper. Is there any way I can get that faked? This is getting kind of faked.
You'd have to take it to some, you know, somebody that's professional on that.
They were married by her father, but she just used to be in jail.
And but you see, back in there in that book, you can see even back then they bought a gallon of whiskey for $1.50. No, I mean, nearly everybody went out of there. They had that wagon train place in Whitebird, Idaho. I don't know if you're familiar with it, but Joe Byram was born in Cottonwood, and about 8 miles south is Grangeville, and about 12 miles south is Whitebird. And Whitebird is where they had that big Indian massacre with the Nez Perce. And so, and Whitebird, well, all those are down in the hole, because you get down the hole to get out of the woods. This was right up on the base of the hill, just out of Whitebird. And we went over there to look that up, and we did find somebody that knew of him. And that was at Cottonwood. The Catholic sisters have a thing there called the Priory. Mm-hmm. There was an elderly sister in there that she knew of him, but she didn't know him personally. Mm-hmm. But she had known of him from the time that he was over there.
This is wonderful. Do you know what's in here? In 1876, Ed Byram sold to John Sweek 9 pounds of beef to Samuel Galbraith. A beef hind quarter, Harvey Sweet, pork, John Sweet, pork, Samuel Galbraith, pork.
They're telling the prices there.
Yeah, the prices.
Well, then some of them got the black one.
Oh my goodness. John Boone.
So I say it's all handwritten out there. That,
so this wasn't just the Idaho thing. He kept this thing.
Oh, yeah, yeah. It's what he called a day book.
Oh, I
gotta
have a chance to really look at
you. Well, you can take
can
a
I take
look.
A, oh, good. Okay.
Well, maker science of
everyone. So as I said, this was the original of the donation land claim. It's signed here by U.S. Grant.
Oh, isn't that marvelous?
Yeah. Reading record.
What? Oh, that's getting up there later years.
What?
We're talking animals or humans now.
It's
well, Bessie, no, let's see, brown cow, Daisy taken to Sweets. So Sweet must have had a bowl. Red cow taken to Galbraith's. Sweet's bowl didn't work.
She's a farm girl. She don't know.
Maybe from the trip.
It tells how much they paid the Chinaman per day.
Well, you know.
Oh, really?
Chinaman Sen, or whatever his name is. Commenced work Tuesday. 5 days work, $5.50.
Oh my goodness.
Wow.
$5.
That's pretty
good. No,
there was
more than
one.
Oh, I know.
You know
on that,
too.
But he was the
one. Rice and cheese.
Rice and cheese.
Well, I'm getting close to the end of what you guys might have some questions, you know.
Okay.
But
Well, did you know Doc Smith, or was he gone before you came?
Doc Smith?
Yeah.
He was around here, but I mean, Frank and Doc, they weren't around here after I got old enough to meet them. You know, because Lizzie took Leonard and Caroline and raised them to the ranch. And so.
What about Lou Francis?
Lou Francis built this barn up here. That was built in about 1915 or 16. I think there's some expenditures in that book on that barn. And that lumber was delivered, bought from Jones Lumber Company, and put on a flat car and delivered it all to the siding here for $7,500. They unloaded it and hauled it up the hill in the wagon. And these first ones here went up to the... Then Lou Francis worked at the golf course. And he lived in the square house right across from the old church of Burdale. And as I say, at the golf course at that time, there were only four or five people that worked, Lou Francis and Jimmy Johnson and Curly Turnbull and, of course, Walt Ames. Then Mr. Cole, 11 Cole, he raked traps and got the leaves out of the traps and all that kind of stuff.
How long has that golf course been there?
Well, it was built. Maybe a little bit before that.
Wow.
So you have to realize that Jewish people couldn't belong to the other clubs. So they built their own.
Oh, really? So that's why it was built?
Yeah.
Oh, I bet.
And it was all built with horses and slip scrapers and local help.
So did they let anybody join in, or
just? And they didn't open that up to regular members or social members after the war.
Really?
Yeah, but most of the big business people in Portland were
good. Yeah. Yeah.
But
they had
to travel a long way. They had nice cars. They could some of them came on a train because they had a stop down there on the train called Gulf Station, just on the south side of the river.
Didn't Lou Francis have something to do with the telephone company too?
No.
No?
Okay. The guy with the telephone company was Henry Jurgens.
That didn't.
Who?
Henry Jurgens. He retired from the phone company there out of Clatskanie.
Hmm.
When he retired, he came to call to do that. But he worked for the phone company up in Clatskanie.
Oh.
Did
he know every word?
He's your uncle.
Now you're talking about your relatives. Be careful.
In this everybody in the country are
No, when Henry Jurgens retired, he came up and bought that little piece of ground from the Blanks. You know where he put his house?
Mm-hmm.
It was out there where they had the Filberts.
Oh, yeah.
And he came from Pottsville there.
That house is still there.
Yeah. I think that Wax house is still there, too. Isn't that another place?
Yeah. No, I don't think it is. I think it's gone.
Well, it has to be just recently.
Where was that one?
The Wax house on Fulton Road. You remember?
Yeah, sure. I think that Bob Herman, but the call Herman Road. I don't think you're thinking there now.
No, no, it's not Herman Road, it's on the Pollock Road. Mm-hmm. It's just short of Post, where Post Road used to be.
Yeah.
Now, Fred, during the war, how did things change in Fulton during the war?
Well, of course, I wasn't here too much, but it didn't change very much because you couldn't do anything. You know, you couldn't buy gas. A stamp was 4 gallons of gas a week. 19 cents, that's 76 cents all you could pay for gas.
Mm.
You know, and you couldn't buy tires, you couldn't do this, you couldn't do that, everything. So everybody had to pitch in and work the shipyard. A lot of these people around Twilight, you know, after World War I, they bought these places. Well, let's say 1918, 1919, 1920, get set up and start going 25, 30, 40 acres. Start raising a family, and then in 1931 and 32, it all went to pot. Well, you couldn't hardly make a living, Well, you certainly couldn't pay the taxes, and you certainly, you know, couldn't pay anything on the loan. But nobody ever lost their place because the bank said, hey, if you can pay the taxes, you can just live there for nothing because we don't want to have to pay the taxes.
Interesting.
You know? Mm-hmm. Or if you went and got a loan, they would ask you what you wanted the loan for. Well, you tell them what you wanted the loan for. Well, you just tell the guy what you want to buy it from, it's okay, and we'll maybe, he owed them money, that you said never pass out the greenbacks. They just put figures on the paper. And so, you know, during the war, it's like here, you didn't have people that had refrigerators because they didn't make them during the war. And, you know, like even in Portland, everything was ice boxes. They still delivered a lot of ice after the war, the ice boxes.
Was there ice delivery here in Walton?
No.
We put it down an abandoned well where it was in Portland.
Well, you know, those days, most everybody had cool covers. And, you know, you bought accordingly. Toxers had, you know, he had ice and refrigeration there, but, I mean, he didn't have those lockers until after the war.
Oh, that was going to be my next question. It's going to
be one. And he put those lockers in, and but that wasn't till then.
They canned meat. People canned meat.
Yep, right. When they bought fresh meat, you know, if they could afford it, but, you know, if you killed an animal, two or three people went together, those women all canned that meat. Mm-hmm. And, of course, the hogs and stuff like that, they processed them, they smoked them. And, you know, branded down in Saltbury.
So when you came to Tualatin, did everybody, all the farmers have farm with horses, or did anybody have tractors?
Well, there wouldn't be tractors. I mean, not speak of, but that, you know, if there's going to be any tractors, Edel would have got the first one, you know, because they farmed a lot of ground. And they did. But Nybergs had, and then Spade Lug McCormick Bearings that had to have it on the swamp. Sagers had one. You know, if you work in the swamp, you had to get on it early enough, and of course, pneumatic tires hadn't come out. The Fortson tractor was almost, it's too light, you know, for heavy work. So the McCormick Bearing was the first one that came out that really would make a ground turn over.
Fred, earlier on you talked about somebody moving a barn. How early was that?
Moving what?
Moving a barn.
That barn down there next to
What year was it?
I believe it was 1926.
How did they do it that long ago?
They tore it down, dismantled it.
Oh, okay.
That down next to where the Bushwhackers is?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
That barn was over on the Lake Oswego Country Club property.
So they just tore it down and built it again?
Yeah. Well, nice. I mean, it's like this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, all you have to do is, those were built with square nails.
Mm-hmm.
And let me tell you what happened. When that fellow went to take that barn down, he went up in there, those were all notched beams, you know, with doweled and pinned. And he went up in there and hung a stick of dynamite up in there and set it off. And when that exploded, that concussion blew all those side walls out, and those boards just lay down. He never busted a one of them.
Oh, my God.
Oh, my God.
Oh, my God.
Oh, my God. Trying to stand in there with the
dynamite. He hung it up in there and lift the thing and got
really?
Out of
Jesus. How did he know that it wasn't going to blow it to bits, though?
Well, it was square nails. It was the square nails. So they didn't have heads on them, and they just... It just, the concussion just, but anyway, then he had a cap. He said, well, this will be easy. The superstructure inside with these dowels and pins, so I'll just pull that over. Well, he found out the harder he pulled on it, the tougher it got.
Oh.
And he had to get a chainsaw in there and saw some of those beams into before he could pull those things over. And all that stuff inside was hand-hewed, you know what? It's all timber country now. They used to saw wood. You know, you talk about cutting old growth. They cut old growth and hauled it down to the iron smelter and got a dollar and a half and two and a half a cord for it. And the only reason they cut the old growth was there's no way to split the second growth. You had to split it with a sledgehammer and a wedge. So they didn't want to cut any naughty stuff. But they hauled, everybody hauled wood to the iron smelter.
Fred, tell us what happened when Zeke Eddy died, about digging the grave.
Oh. Well, he passed away in August of 1944. And of course, Fred Breakbush was sexton of the cemetery, but he had some heart problems. Of course, he couldn't dig. And so he took us out there and showed us. Well, we knew where it was because we were in the family plot. But he showed us about, it was getting close to the last one, so we stayed away from anything else. And so it was in August, and that day, it must have been 100. So we started, and of course...
Now who started? You and who else?
Ed Blank and myself, and Joe Byram was there, and Rod Dickinson. Now this was 44, so he's probably 16, 17 years old. So anyway, you only one person digging a hole at a time, so we just switched off and took time. And so his mother came down there, and he was down in the hole, and of course he was beaded up with perspiration. And boy, she got out of that car, and man, he demanded him to get out of that hole and get dried off, or he had a heart attack. So Joe Barham, he talked kind of slow and he chewed a little tobacco. And he says, well, I tell you, Dorothy, he said, you ought to get that blanket out of the car and blanket him down like a prize racer. So, it's those are the things you have to do, nowadays. It just happens that way. But I was going to tell you another little story. Over where the post road is, when John and Fred Wish had the saloon in Vaughan, over where the old First Church was, over the old part of town by the SP Depot.
That the El Rey saloon?
Yeah. There was a Belgian that lived up what you would call post road, but at that time it was just a driveway. Post hadn't come out here and there was no street there because the first street went back to his house. Anyway, his name was Pete Windingdale, and he was a Belgian. And he worked for the Washington County Road Department, and he, dynamited, blew stumps and stuff like that. So they got down there one day and got to drinking, and one thing led to another, and one thing led to another. And he just said to these guys, I've lived long enough, he said, I'm going to commit suicide. So he went out there out of the saloon. It was a big stump. So he bored a hole under that stump, was working on it like he was going to put a charge of dynamite in it. So what he did is he put the cap on the end of the fuse and put it down the hole and packed it all back down in there. Had about six foot of fuse on it. And it burns about 2 foot a minute. So he got that in there and lit it, and of course it's smoking away. He got up and laid down on top of the stump. The stump was big enough for him to lay down on. He told them all goodbye. And that thing just went down there and plopped like a big firecracker. He got up off the stump and went home. So then I don't know whether any of you knew about Hobie Baker. He lived up on 105th Avenue. He used to raise onions in the swamp over here in the Cypole and over the hedge of the swamp. Anyway, they got to drinking down there and had a flagpole. I don't know if you ever had a picture, but there was a flagpole out there. And
flagpole out where?
In front of that El Rey Saloon.
Oh.
There's a flagpole up there about 40 feet high. And so that flagpole needed painting, and of course these guys got to drinking. Offer somebody $5 if he could paint the flagpole. So Hobie Baker said he'd take that bet. So, bucket of paint and a paintbrush. So he went over to John Wish's fence with a pair of pliers and cut 5 or 6 feet of wire out of the fence. So then he got the paint in the bucket and he put the wire around the front of his shoes, around the back of his shoes, and he shinnied up the pole clear at the top, see? And when he wanted to stop, he just rocked back on his heels. And that wire bit in both sides. So he just painted down the pole. He painted down the pole, and after a few minutes, he was all done. He lost $9.
Fred, what happened to the El Rey Saloon?
When we were kids, of course, when Prohibition came in 1920, Roosevelt took office in 1933, and it took about a year and a half to get beer made again. you don't get everything back going. So, I mean, when it went in prohibition, that thing just deteriorated.
So 12 years or so?
Yeah. From 20 to, well, it's more than 12, about 14 years. You see, because Roosevelt didn't take office until 33.
So it just kind of deteriorated and wasn't...
You know, when we were kids, there was part of the building standing there, but, you know, they turned... Wish had that pasture cleared on the golf station, mm-hmm. and they turned cows loose in there, and they'd rub up against the boards, and it gets more or less deteriorated. And,
what about the dance hall down there?
Huh?
What about the dance hall that was there?
Well, the park down there... In the early 30s, the Bolsheviks came out here, and of course they had a youth program. And they got a hold of that property some way. I don't know who they got the property from or who owned it, because the Smiths certainly should have owned it if they had the sawmill back there, because it was the only way that they could get to the sawmill. But anyway, they came out here, and they had a summer youth program, well, in 1920 they had the Bolshevik Revolution, and these were some of the ones that wanted their youth to have summer camp meetings and things like that. So they came out and developed the park. They put that humongous dance hall and everything in there and everything, and fixed it up and put in swimming facilities and everything like that. Well, they went around town here and sold shares in that. And if you paid $10 a share, you had a lifetime membership to that for families. So a lot of people jumped at it. But the only stipulation was that during their 3-week camp meeting in the summertime, you couldn't intermingle with them. They had their camp set up north of the railroad trestle, and whatever they did, if they wanted to come down and swim at 3 o'clock in the afternoon to 4 o'clock, then nobody else could be down there. But, you know, they worked around that as only 3 weeks out of the year. So it was a great opportunity. I mean, those kids lived in the railroad.
Sure.
You know, it's hard to believe at that time, with not very good sanitation and everything like that, and that was a recreational river in those days there. Now with all the things and the environmental things they put on, that river isn't clean today. You know, there'd be people canoeing on that river, motorboating. Bud Knudsen fished crawfish, you know. And he was a great supplier for Yates Crawfish for years and years and years and years.
Was he the man that...
lived down by Johnny Bones.
Oh, did he?
Yep. Harry Chandler, Dr. Chandler lived down there.
Yeah.
Johnny Bones and this bud. And he...
Well, I heard that Knudsen, I think other one told me, Knudsen was drowned in the river?
I think he did.
Yes.
Because he used to, you know, bring his crawfish down at Zuber. Would pick them up with a truck at the south end of the Tullet River there. He had these, like, chicken crates years ago, but he'd be little holes in them where the crawfish couldn't crawl out, but mm-hmm. he'd pick them up maybe once or twice a week. So he'd walk uptown and get gasoline for his motor, his motorboat in the river, and maybe some groceries. And he kept acting the same way with Toshman's at Wilsonville. They fish crawfish, you know.
Was the river clear or not?
Sure.
Oh, it was clear? You could see to the bottom?
Well, you couldn't see the bottom, but...
You can never see through that. But well, a little better it is now, not much.
The fall was kind of...
Well, yeah, but I mean, there was never, since I've been in town here, heard anybody having typhoid fever or diphtheria or anything like that on any of this water, and the kids lived in the water. And a lot of people don't realize it. You know, the Tallit River feeds like Oswego.
That's right.
And,
I'm going to interrupt for a minute. We'll have a few more questions and then maybe wrap this up.
Oh,
I want to invite you, Marion's talking about for our July picnic, having people come and reminisce and talk about, you know, time Tualatin and then all of that. And I would like, you know, everyone here obviously to come and bring people and whatever, but... certainly, thank you.
Well, that's great.
Let's have a few more questions, and then we need to get on with our business meeting, and then there's an ad hoc Hedges House meeting after the meeting. But we really do appreciate you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Oh, there we go.
Yeah.
If there's a couple more questions, go ahead and ask, and then wrap it up.
Well, Charlie Roberts, he was a marshal here for years and years and years. I don't know whether he ever arrested anybody or tried any bullying. But he scared people. He kept the people from getting into trouble. He was the superintendent over at the Washington County Crusher at the end of where Durham Road comes out, you know, years ago, where that elbow studs is. Well, he just went right straight across there and went into the Tiger and Washington County Crusher plant there. They had three gravel trucks down here. Ed White drove one, and John Haig Sr. drove the other one, and Clyde Young drove the other one. They were Bulldog Max with chain drive. You could hear them coming from the country mile.
Thank you ever so much, Fred. That's been so good. Yeah, you seem to have your stock.
You guys go ahead. I'll sit here when you get this thing, to get those pictures out of here.